We're very happy today to have as our colloquium speaker, as jointly with the ongoing conference, Professor Nathan Seiberg, as I'm sure you know. Professor Seiberg is one of the leading quantum field theorists and high energy theorists in the world today. He has won many awards, including a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship and the Foundational Physics Prize and the Dirac Medal. And his discoveries include Seiberg duality and Seiberg-Witten theory, and he'll tell us about quantum field theory today.
Thank you. It's really a great honor and pleasure to be here. This is a pleasure that I have not had often during the last few years of giving a talk in person. It's really exciting. And I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this interesting conference, even though I'm not a member of the collaboration, and also to give this talk here. I see here a very diverse audience. In fact, I'm not quite sure what fields of math or physics are represented. And this makes me very happy, because I'm a strong believer in the unity of math and physics. And I'm confident that interdisciplinary activity, like the one that is being promoted in this Simons collaboration, that we've heard these wonderful talks here, I'm confident that this will be very productive and will have interesting results in the future. On the other hand, there is a problem here, which is quite a challenge for me to give this talk to this diverse audience on a rather technical topic. And I figured that there's no way I could satisfy everybody all the time, given the diverse topics and all that. And so I decided to start at a very, very low level and gradually go up. Hopefully, I will intersect the knowledge of everybody at some point through the talk, and hopefully the point that they could stay with me will be long enough. And since there might be people here who do not have and complete understanding of quantum field theory, I thought I would start by putting things in context and give a very, very broad brush map of physics, the way I understand it, and which will also highlight why I think quantum field theory is so important. So we start with classical physics. So my map will have 2x2 coordinates. On one axis, I'll have classical physics and quantum physics, and then the other axis, I'll have the number of degrees of freedom, finite or infinite. So classical physics started very early on, and I put pictures here of Newton and Lagrange, and it describes the time evolution of a finite number of particles. And in the course of doing that, there are also many other people contributed. Calculus, to some extent, grew out of this problem. And the language that we use is ordinary differential equations. So ODE is the math chapter that describes classical mechanics in one way or another. And from that, people also took it to symplectic geometry and all sorts of other more advanced topics. Then the more sophisticated version came with the number of degrees of freedom became infinite. In fact, the continuum of degrees of freedom. And we can talk about Navier-Stokes. We can talk about Maxwell, Einstein. All of them studied classical field theory. There was a field on space-time, and the field evolves as a function of time, and we solve a PDE rather than an ODE. So again, it's another branch of calculus. The mass that is relevant is PDE, and again, there are more sophisticated versions that came later. This brings us to the 20th century, where we had quantum mechanics. So we again have a 2x2 entries in my map. So the total map is 2x2. I'm now in the bottom column of quantum mechanics. And we start with finite number of degrees of freedom. These are some of the people who contributed to this understanding. And here we describe the time evolution of a finite number of degrees of freedom. And the finite number could be macroscopic. It could be 10 to the 23 or whatever, but the number is still finite. Large but finite quantum particles or number of degrees of freedom. And again, there is a natural mathematical language for it. We can either use operators acting in a Hilbert space, something that is fully understood by mathematicians, or many physicists like the functional integral, which in this case, I think, can almost be made rigorous. So that is very satisfactory. And all we need to do is complete the square, add the last entry in our map. And this is quantum field theory, and we just follow our nose. It's a time evolution of an infinite number, a continuum of degrees of freedom. Or just as we move from classical mechanics to quantum mechanics here, and we just quantize the classical motion that we had before, all we need to do is take the PDEs that we had before and make them quantum. That's easier said than done. This is a huge challenge to make it precise. But this didn't stop physicists from making enormous progress over the 20th century, and now in the 21st century, understanding this in many different setups. A lot is known, but there's still very exciting progress, and we've heard beautiful talks about related topics here in the conference. My personal view is that a new intellectual structure is needed. So when the analog of this entry in my table, operators in the Hilbert space of functional integral, here we need something new, something that perhaps does not yet exist. And one reason for that is that it cannot yet be made rigorous. So all the steps that we do here, every one of them, we can try and push it here, we can make it rigorous to some extent, but there's no completely satisfactory story that works all the time. Now, quantum field theory, even though it's not yet mathematically rigorous, is enormously powerful. It is the most powerful theory in all of human knowledge, not only in physics, everywhere, as far as agreeing with experiment, and I'm talking about natural sciences, not mathematics. And quantum field theory is everywhere. And this is, I'll give just one example showing how accurate it is. So in particle physics, it is the language used in describing particle physics. It gives us a very satisfactory, very accurate description of nature. This is not a typical example, but it shows the power of the methods. This is the magnetic dipole moment of the electron, and it has some number that is computed theoretically to be this one, and experimentally, it is this one. Even the fact that it starts with a one is already an enormous success. This is something that Dirac was the first to show. It follows from Dirac's theory. The one that appears here, the fact that there is 001, this one is also very important. This is one loop correction in QED. This is fundamentally important and agrees, works between theory and experiment. And more digits here explore more and more details of the standard model. They study details of the strong interactions and the weak interaction and renormalization and the fact that we have to deal with infinities. All this is lumped into this calculation. And such a success, such enormous success, is unprecedented in science. There isn't a single branch of science anywhere which gets to such enormous accuracy between agreement between theory and experiment. And we can take many lessons from it. One is, perhaps it's not mathematically rigorous, but it works. There's no question that this is right and we know what we are doing. The second lesson is mostly a lesson for theorists. As you can see, the experimentalists are ahead of us. They have one more digit. And that means that we should work harder and compute more digits. And we want the accuracy not for the sake of accuracy. I personally don't care about this accuracy. We care about it because if we have a discrepancy, it might tell us that there's something wrong in our understanding of the standard model. And indeed, over the last several years, there were such discrepancies that came up, especially in the context of the similar calculation for the muon. So we should stay tuned and see whether we could actually, this thing would stay or not. So this is in particle physics. In condensed matter physics, it's equally impressive. In fact, the study of quantum field theory over the 20th century grew together in condensed matter physics and in particle physics with a lot of cross-fertilization between the two fields. The leaders of the field really benefited from advances and from interactions with people in the other field. And I can point to various milestones in the understanding of quantum field theory, renormalization, spontaneous symmetry breaking, Higgs mechanism, and so forth. All of them originated in one field and were borrowed in the other one. And here it leads to a detailed description of the long distance behavior of material, what kind of phases we can have, and the phase transitions between them. And I'll say a lot more about that later in the talk. Even in cosmology, quantum field theory is very powerful. It is used in discussing the early universe, fluctuation in the microwave background, inflation, and so forth. And in string theory and quantum gravity, quantum field theory also appears. It appears in many different places. It appears on the string world sheet. It is the low energy approximation of string theory. That's good. If low energy string theory had not looked like quantum field theory, it would not agree with the real world. And in the context of gauge gravity duality, it gives us the whole theory. Every one of these bullet points deserves its own seminar or its own colloquium. So I'm not going to spend more time mentioning it, except that I want you to see the long list of applications. And quite surprisingly, even though it is not mathematically rigorous, it yet had applications in mathematics. So I don't know to what extent this is precedented or not, that you take something which is not rigorous in physics and you get application in math. Actually, I can think of many historical examples where this thing happened, and the Dirac delta function is one of them, but there are also many others in the early days of calculus. So we have it here. And what all this tells us is that there's something very deep and very interesting going on, and we should study it. So what I will do today is focus on one aspect of quantum field theory. And in fact, this is something which is true in philosophy and in almost all branches of human knowledge. And this is the phenomenon of separation of scales. The point is that we use different descriptions to describe nature at different length scales or different energy scales. And we have a coherent, complete description, or almost complete description, of phenomena length scale by length scale, and the description changes. Let me be more precise and give more details about that. First of all, we have simplification. We can study what happens at one length scale, at one energy scale, without knowing what happens at other length scales. We can study classical mechanics, balls moving on an inclined plane or pendula and whatever. We don't need to understand quantum mechanics for that. We don't need to understand the structure of the atom for this. Otherwise, it would have been impossible. Imagine that we had to know all of physics simultaneously, all the thing about the big universe, cosmology, what happens in quantum gravity, everything, in order to understand any phenomenon in everyday life. In fact, this idea of, which I put here, peeling the onion, that our understanding of nature progresses step by step by finding inner, deeper and deeper truth at shorter and shorter distances, this is very common in philosophy, and it's known as reductionism. We are trying to explain phenomena at one length scale using deeper truth at shorter length scales. But we don't have to. We can stay in the length scale we are interested in. So just to show you how common this thing is, let me mention some examples. In the case of the thermodynamics, people studied, starting with Navier and Stokes and even earlier, there are certain equations that describe the motion of fluids. The deeper understanding is that the PDE, or the equation that describe a smooth fluid, is really only an approximation. In the real world, the fluid is not smooth. If you look at it very closely, there are atoms there and they bounce around and so forth. You don't need to understand the atoms in order to understand the motion of the fluid. The motion of the fluid is an effective description. The differential equation that describes the motion of the fluid is an effective description, which is very useful. It's very useful because we don't have to keep track of every single molecule in the fluid. So that's in hydrodynamics. We have the same thing in thermodynamics. People studied thermodynamics before they knew about statistical mechanics. So the original understanding of thermodynamics with entropy and other notions, there was no statistics there, there was no microscopic understanding, and it worked very well. And the same thing is true there. There is a more microscopic description in terms of the more fundamental degrees of freedom, but it's not essential. Over the last several years, many of us became interested in epidemiology. And again, we can talk about the structure of the virus and its RNA and how we'll build vaccines to affect the virus. This is a very microscopic theory. And then, at a longer length scale, we're not that interested in the RNA of the virus or exactly how the virus works. We just have to keep social distancing and wear masks, and that's good to protect us. And we have an effective theory which uses only the masks, and we don't need to understand all the details. And at a more global scale, we have travel restrictions between countries, and I'll have to do a PCR test later this week in order to go to the US, and that's independent of the question of masks. So at different length scales, we have different descriptions, which are kind of independent of all the detail, of most of the details at shorter distances. And in the context of quantum field theory, this is not just a philosophical idea telling us how fortunate we are that nature is kind to us, that everything comes in steps, we don't need to understand everything. In the context of quantum field theory, this actually becomes a calculational tool. And I think these are the two main heroes of this story, Ken Wilson and Steve Weinberg. And they described phenomena at different length scales and turned that into an equation. So these are not just words, but that we have different theories, but we can continuously move from one description to another using what is known as the renormalization group. And this is fundamental in quantum field theory. And as I have emphasized, it's fundamental in all of human knowledge, this separation of scale, and it's also fundamental, even more so, in quantum field theory. So we'll use terminology of using two kinds of length scales, what we call UV, for short distances, and IR for long distances, and my color codes will be that the IR will be red, and the UV will be this kind of violet-purple thing, and I'll try to stick to this color coding. So we formulate a problem at short distances. For example, we put atoms in a box, or we write some Lagrangian that we would like to study, or we have some rules about what happens at short distances, and our goal is to find the answer what happens at longer distances. So you can view this as a problem. The UV theory is a problem. This is what we would like to solve. And this is the answer. We start at short distances with a problem, and our goal is to figure out what the system does at long distances. And what we mean by that is that we don't need to understand every detail about the short distance theory, only the gross features of the long distance theory, only kind of approximate things that are valid at long distances. In particular, we would like to understand what kind of phases the system will have. Will it be a conductor or a fluid? Will it have red? Will it look like red or not? Will it be opaque or not, et cetera? So will it be flexible and so forth? And one aspect of this simplification, of this separation of scales, is that the long distance physics is independent of most of the details of the short distance physics. We've seen that before, when we gave the various examples of epidemiology or thermodynamics or others, we have a lot of details at short distances. We have some atoms bouncing around and they interact in one form or another. Most of this information is totally irrelevant. And there's a very precise technical term, what we mean by irrelevant. So most of the details are gone, and the description at long distances is very efficient. Efficient in the sense that it doesn't depend on a lot. So in the case of in hydrodynamics, molecules could bounce around and there could be molecules of different materials and they could be denser or not and so forth. When you write the Navier-Stokes equation to describe it, there's a small number of parameters and that's all that is relevant. And the rest is kind of not important. In that sense, it's effective. It's very effective. And in fact, this is a technical term here. It's called an effective theory. And in fact, even if the UV theory, the theory at short distances, is on the lattice, by the time we are at long distances, the lattice is gone, and the material looks smooth. We saw that in the example of hydrodynamics. At short distances, there is no clear shape of the water or of whatever fluid you have, because there are all these atoms that bounce around. At long distances, it looks as if it is smooth. In fact, if I look at the podium here, it looks perfectly smooth to me. Even though if I look at it with a microscope, it will not be smooth at all. There will be all these atoms there that are arranged. Therefore, the theory at short distances could be a theory on a lattice, some crystal. And at long distances, it looks like we are in the continuum. The interplay between the lattice and the continuum is important both conceptually, that we think that there might be an underlying lattice underneath, which is washed out by the time we're at long distances. But it could also be useful numerically if we are interested in the continuum problem. I could be interested only in PDEs, be interested only in the continuum problem. If I want to solve it numerically, I have to put it on the computer. When I put it on the computer, I have to discretize it. So So the lattice, the interplay between the continuum and the lattice is a two-way street. We could have a physical lattice in the system, and then our long-distance continuum description is an approximation of it. Or I could say that the problem I'm interested in is the continuum problem, and then I discretize or approximate it by a lattice so that I can put it on the computer. And these two elements will be crucial soon. So this is like approximating an integral by a sum or approximating a sum by an integral. So now let's take a particular Hamiltonian. So we put the system in a box. It's always good to put the system in a finite box so that there are all sorts of complications when the box is infinite. So we'll keep the box finite but large. And then there's a Hamiltonian, and we are very powerful. We diagonalize the Hamiltonian. We completely solve the system. And roughly speaking, the answer could be one of two kinds. Number one is a function of energy. We have a ground state, maybe one or finite number of states. There's a gap in the spectrum, and then there's a continuum. So this is one kind of spectrum that we could have. And then, since we are interested in the behavior at long distances, we are only interested in the low energy field theory, in the low energy description, which includes only these ground states, and we throw away all these higher energy states. So an example of that is a free massive particle. So here we have particles with various momenta, and they have different energies. And here we have a ground state where there is no particle at all. It's a very boring system. It has only one state, the vacuum, and there isn't much we can say about it. In more interesting cases, there could be some interesting structure here. Another possibility is that there is no gap. So that's called gapless. And an example would be photons or massless particles. So massless particles do not have a gap. I can go to low energies and focus on the low-lying states of the Hamiltonian. But no matter how low I go, there will still be a continuum underneath. So this is another kind of behavior. This is a qualitative feature that things look this way or that way. More technically, what we describe here at low energies is known as a topological field theory. And what we see here is a conformal field theory. So these are just names at this point, and these names will not be important for the rest of the talk. And since there are some experts in the audience, I put a disclaimer that there's a more refined classification depending on more details. Now, let's say a little bit more about these different theories in the different scales. So at short distances, we have something complicated, the short distance theory. It could be on a lattice, it could be in the continuum, could be many different things. And our goal is to find the long distance behavior. As I said before, this is the question and this is the answer. And as we explore it, the first thing we'd like to know, what phase will it be in? So we'd like to classify the all possible answers. We would like to have a catalog of all possible answers we could have. Because the kind of questions we can put on the lattice, say, or at short distances more generally, there's an infinite number of Hamiltonians I can write down, and there's an infinite number of answers we can get, but it's a much smaller infinity. So our goal is to classify what we have here, and this leads us to, this is again a two-way street, quantum field theory helps us organize the long-distance behavior, and conversely, if we find an interesting new phase, it teaches us something new about quantum field theory. And over the last several decades, we've seen many examples of going back and forth between them. So this long-distance theory, more mathematically, is expected to be scale-invariant, and hence the name conformal field theory, and a subset of them are topological field theories, and a subset of them are invertible topological field theory. And as we go down the list, the theory becomes simpler and simpler, and less interesting. This is common in physics. The simpler it is, the more you can say, and therefore it's less interesting. Now, this is the question of what happens at long distances. But what's most interesting in physics is not just to understand what's going on here at long distances, but to understand the relation between what happens at short distances and at long distances. And over the last few days, we've heard a number of fascinating talks about mathematicians trying to put more flesh on these ideas of going from short distances to long distances, considering massive theories, interacting theories, and understanding how the perturbation expansion works and so forth. So let me give a concrete example of all that. So we start with a lattice. So remember my color coding, that's the ultraviolet, the lattice. And I approximate space by, or space-time by a lattice. For example, a cubic lattice, but I can have more sophisticated lattices. And we place some degrees of freedom at the vertices and the links. I'm told that mathematicians call them edges between the lattice. And we can put various interactions, say it's a Hamiltonian and the spin here, degree of freedom here, time. The Hamiltonian has terms that multiply degrees of freedom at different places. Crucial point, it should be short range, which means that every degree of freedom on the lattice appears in the Hamiltonian only a finite number away from that point. It doesn't couple to things very far. This is a restriction we put. And that's the question. We put a system, this is the Hamiltonian, or this is the Lagrangian. And as we go to low energies or long distances, typically the long distance description of the system is given by some continuum quantum field theory. And the ingredients that go into this, and this was a folk theorem, that this has to be the case. It has to be the case if you start at short distances with a Hamiltonian or action, with short-range interactions, namely every degree of freedom talks only to a finite number of neighbors, then no matter what you do at long distances, it becomes a quantum field theory, a continuum quantum field theory. That could be these gapless ones, or it could be the gapped ones, and so forth, and there's further refinement. But no matter what you do at short distances, at long distances, we have this separation of scales. Whatever you put on the lattice at short distances, at long distances, there's an effective description in terms of continuum quantum field theory. And as I said earlier, in condensed matter physics, the lattice is real. And in high energy physics, the lattice is an invention helping us to make the problem more well-defined, and also important in order to do numerical calculations. So this is all very nice. This is the first part of the talk. And if I had to give this talk 20, 30 years ago, I would have probably given the talk exactly as I've just said. But over the last several years, mostly the last few years, but it actually started earlier, we have seen a number of signs that this picture is incomplete. This picture that I talked about since the beginning of the talk, with separation of scales and things happening at short distances and things happening at long distances, and it could be a lattice or a continuum, all that comes into a question. At this point, I would like to say that in earlier days, I knew it was not rigorous, and I talked a lot to mathematicians. Mathematicians complained that quantum field theory is not rigorous. And they had all sorts of problems. You know, you take these limits, maybe the limits don't exist. And my attitude was, of course they exist. It works. You know, it's enormous success, of course it works. So yeah, these I's need to be dotted and the T's need to be crossed, but it's guaranteed to work and so forth. I now think that all this unease that the mathematicians had is completely vindicated, because we have new examples where this simple picture is not true. So let me go through some examples, a list of examples. And I would call them UVIR mixing. I talked earlier about the separation between the UV and the IR, the separation between short distances and long distances. And now we put them together. And the UV and the IR are mixed together. And I should emphasize, the mathematicians should not be surprised by it, perhaps. Physicists should be shocked by it, because this is against the way we studied physics for centuries. This is saying that whether the US does or does not impose travel restrictions in the US depends on the details of the RNA of the virus. This is a good analogy how the UV and the IR are completely mixed together. What happens in solving the differential equations of Navier and Stokes depends on the fact that we have this kind of atoms or another kind of atom, which looks like, to describe different length scale, what do they have to do with each other? So the first place that this thing appeared is in gravity. And in fact, in gravity, UV and IR are completely mixed together. The easiest way to see that is to take a lot of energy and put it in a small region. And we just pump more and more energy into it. hoping to explore what happens at higher energies in the shorter distances. But gravity tricks us, and when we put a lot of energy in some finite region, it makes a black hole. And as we pump more and more energy in, the black hole becomes bigger. And as the black hole becomes bigger, it hides from us what happens at shorter distances. This is the simplest version to say that, and we can say it in more sophisticated ways. Also, in the context of string theory, we have a lot of examples with there is a duality between small things and large things. So in the context of gravity, we have a lot of examples where what happens at short distances and long distances is completely mixed together. In fact, we can't even tell whether a certain phenomenon is a short distance phenomenon or a long distance phenomenon. It's completely confusing. Well, what one could say, well, gravity is a theory of space-time. Length scale or energies are properties of space-time. Maybe we shouldn't be surprised that the whole structure of space-time and what we mean by long distance and short distance gets confused, because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the structure of space-time. Maybe we shouldn't be so puzzled by it. But this would be the wrong conclusion to draw from this, because we have several examples of theories without gravity in which the UV and the IR are also mixed together. The first examples of that came in the study of string theory. And again, we heard some beautiful talks about this earlier today. We take string theory, and we take some limit when Newton constant goes to zero. As we do that, gravity decouples. So string theory is a consistent theory. We took a limit such that there is no gravity. So we are left with a theory without gravity. So now we don't have anymore the excuse that space-time is dynamical, it's confusing, we don't know what it is, because space-time is completely rigid. Nothing is going to happen to it, because Newton constant went to zero. And in most cases, when we take such a limit, we find a quantum field theory. This is a great success of our understanding. And in fact, today we heard about new quantum field theories that are found this way by taking such a limit. But that's not always the case. In some peculiar cases, we see limits that exhibit mixing between the UV and IR. So I'll just mention them here. Every one of them is a topic of another colloquium. I'm not going to discuss it in detail, except to say that they exist and they come out of string theory. The first is known as little string theory. It is characterized by having no local operators. That's the first surprising thing. And it has T-duality, which means that long distances and short distances are mixed together. I think historically that was the first example. Then there's something called field theory or non-commutative space-time. Again, a very peculiar system. I'm not going to discuss it in detail. What happens there is the degrees of freedom are kind of dipoles. And as you give the dipole high momentum in one direction, the dipole grows in the orthogonal direction. So as you try to explore what happens at high energy, the dipole grows and actually probes what happens at very long distances. It sounds very physical, very anti-physical, that you pump more energy in, you explore what happens at longer distances. It's not what you get, say, in a Fourier transform. And there's an issue of divergences. I'm not going to discuss it here. So until recently, I thought, in the context of gravity, we're not surprised at all that we have UVIR mixing, and string theory gives us these examples, but maybe these examples are kind of esoteric. We shouldn't spend too much time on them. Because after all, most applications of quantum field theory, we have some material in the lab, we have a lattice, we write a Lagrangian, we have a Hamiltonian, and we study what happens. And no mixing between UV and IR could happen. Well, that's not true. There are certain exotic lattice models, and that's what I'll talk about the rest of the talk, including models of fractals, and they do exhibit mixing of UV and IR. And these systems, which I will soon review, have the property, we can present them from many different directions, have the property that they can be defined on a Hamiltonian, on a lattice, lattice Hamiltonian, with short-range interactions. So they satisfy all the premises of this folk theorem. And at long distances, they are not captured by a standard quantum field theory. This was a shock to me. In fact, the first time I heard about it, I thought there's no way this would be right. But it violated the lore of decades, and it violated this folk theorem. And it's true, and I think this is an issue which has to be addressed, and I think it asks for an explanation, a better explanation. So let me first give a list of some examples so that we know I'm not talking about the empty set. There are some exotic models. I'll review them soon. And they come from different, motivated by different considerations. In fact, they were not even lumped together as different aspects of the same problem until recently. And I'll say more about them soon. There's something known as Lifshitz theory. This has been studied for decades. There's something called the XY plaquette model by Parmakanti et al. This is, I think, one or two decades. And various fracton models, this is closer. This is, again, one or two decades, and many other examples. So these are well-defined continuum or lattice models. But when you start exploring them further, you see that the continuum field theory is not quite meaningful. If you just follow your nose and write the continuum field theory description of it, it breaks down. And the challenge to that comes from the peculiar properties. So since these models are well-defined on the lattice, there's a well-defined lattice model, many of them are solvable, so there's no room to hide. You solve the model, you look at the answer, that's the answer, let's try and describe it using field theory, and we fail. So I'll give you some examples of that. Soon, but first let me enumerate their peculiar properties, which makes them so interesting or challenging, depending on your point of view. First, they have very unusual global symmetries, symmetries that we had not seen earlier in quantum field theory. They have global symmetries that depend on space. So we see that space plays a more important role than in ordinary field theory. There are symmetries where the symmetry transformation parameter depends on where we are in space. Not in time. Time, everything is standard. These are not gauge symmetries. These are global symmetries, but the transformation parameter depends on where we are in space. They also have excitations with restricted mobility. So they are excitations, finite energy excitations, which look like a particle, but the particle cannot move around. And it's not that it cannot move around because you need to give it a lot of energy in order to move it. It cannot move around, period. It could split in, if you give enough energy, it could break into other particles in different places, but the particle is a localized excitation, cannot move around. It's stuck at a point. And sometimes it is restricted to move on a line or move on a plane. This is not something that I had seen earlier. In fact, nobody had seen it earlier. The other thing is that we're still on the lattice. And imagine we have a lattice with periodic boundary conditions with Lx, Ly, and Lz sites in the different directions. And we diagonalize the Hamiltonian exactly, and we look at the ground states. And we have a very large ground state degeneracy. A typical formula is like that. So the system is gapped. There are ground states, and then there are some excitations. And the number of ground states is very high. The number of ground states is typically of the form 2 to a power that depends on how many sites the lattice has. And the limit, as we try to take the number of sites to infinity, is not well defined. Depending on how we take the limit to infinity, this object k has a different limit. And in many cases, it's even infinite. So some of you study topological field theory. The number of ground states is finite. It depends on the topology of space and so forth. The number here is infinite. If you take the continuum limit, the number of ground states of the system is infinite. In fact, this was one of the motivations to study these systems, because the idea was that this would be some kind of a quantum memory that has a lot of states. And other properties of this state will make it robust so that it's not sensitive to noise. This was one of the motivations to study them. But the direction I'm taking this talk, so I don't care where it came from, I'm just puzzled by the fact that these things exist. So these are the ground states. And they have UVIR mixing. In fact, the very fact that the number of ground states depends on how many sites we have is already some kind of a UVIR mixing. A detail at short distances that should not affect what happens at long distances affects a long distance quantity, like how many ground states the system has. This is very strange, and it's the first time we see here this UVIR mixing. And there are many other peculiarities that I do not mention here. Of course, this raises many questions. Are these peculiarities related? They sound completely different. In fact, not all examples have all the peculiarities. Different examples have some peculiarities. Other examples have other peculiarities. Altogether, it sounds like there's a whole zoo of exotic systems there. We don't understand them, and they do not fit the regular framework that we are familiar with. How should we think of such theories? We have this quantum field theory that we know and love, and it's crashing here. It doesn't work. So how should we think of them? And this is not just for our own interest. We would like to classify this system, know how to organize them. And if we understand how to classify them and organize them, maybe we'll find new examples with more peculiarities. And we should go back to our starting point. We know and love quantum field theory. It's been with us for a while. It's been enormously successful with all these applications I talked about. Can we fit this story into standard quantum field theory? Is there a way to slightly change the rules of quantum field theory such as we can accommodate these systems? And we know that quantum field theory barely makes sense. In fact, some mathematicians say it's not rigorous at all. So if you thought that quantum field theory is not rigorous at all, now we see examples which show that where we really need to bend the rules a little bit and accommodate more subtle objects that are not included in the standard picture. So let me now mention, just a note, I'm not talking about the empty set. I'll briefly describe some examples that people studied. These are lattice models. And the goal is not that you follow all the details of the lattice model construction, but to show you that I'm going to fit the whole model on one slide, which shows that it's not that crazy. So the first one is the model by Vijay High and Fu. This was not historically the first. It's the simplest to present. We have a lattice, and on the links of the lattice, I'm told it's called the edges of the lattice, we put Z2 spin. In modern terminology, we put a qubit on every link of the lattice. And all these, there's a Hamiltonian that acts on the qubits, and it has four kinds of terms. A term associated with cubes, I'll soon write it, and three terms associated with the sites in the x, y, and z directions. So the cube interaction, we take the Pauli metric sigma 1, and we multiply it around all the links of the cube. So that's a well-defined thing. This is the first term here. This is the first term, and we sum it over all the cubes. And the second term, we pick a site, this one, and we look on the plane, either perpendicular to x or to y or to z, and we take sigma 3 at these links, and we multiply them together. This is this term, and we sum that over the different orientations and over the different sites. This might not look like the first thing you would guess. It's not the first thing you would write down, but it's not that much more complicated than, say, the Ising model, which is the canonical example of a lattice model. There are some qubits, and they interact with each other. This is the Hamiltonian. And I wrote here, innocent-looking local Hamiltonian. Local, every spin, every degree of freedom talks only to a finite number of neighbors. And it's innocent-looking. You don't see here that there's anything peculiar, anything long-range, anything non-standard. This system is exactly solvable. And when you solve it, you find all these peculiarities that I mentioned earlier. If I have a lattice with Lx times Ly times Lz sites in the different directions, this is the number of ground states. Again, this is a solvable model. There's no room to hide. This is the answer. This is the number of ground states. And this by itself is crazy. The number of ground states of the system depends on how many sites the lattice has. That's something that is unusual. The second thing which is unusual about it is that if I take the number of sites to infinity, it diverges. The third thing that is unusual about it is if I take the logarithm of the number of states, that's known as the entropy. We know that entropy could be extensive, namely proportional to the volume, or it could be finite, as in ordinary field theories. Here, it is subextensive. It grows, it is infinite and grows linearly in the size of the system. If we try to take a continuum limit, namely take all these L's to infinity, produce a lattice spacing A going to zero, recall my color coding. This is UV, this is IR. And as we take A to zero, the number of sites to infinity with fixed length of the box, this answer is infinite. So if we have a very finer and finer lattice in finite volume, the number of ground states of the system is infinite. And the behavior, the reason we have an infinity, is that the behavior of the ground states, all these many, many ground states, is very sensitive to what happens at short distances. So this is a clear sign of this UVIR mixing. We have the lattice, and the difference between the different states, the different ground states, depends on what happens at tiny distances. This is unlike the example of hydrodynamics that I mentioned earlier. If one atom bounces around a little bit differently, it makes no difference to the solution of Navier-Stokes equation. The solution of Navier-Stokes equation doesn't care about what any small number of atoms that can move around differently, it doesn't make a difference. And here it does. The spectrum of this model is gapped, and it also has the interesting property that small deformations of it do not change the low energy physics. So if I take the Hamiltonian, you say, okay, this is a very special Hamiltonian. What if I change it a little bit? As long as the deformation is sufficiently small, the answer I presented here is unchanged. So the answers are robust. That's also important because you say in the real material, the Hamiltonian will not be exactly that one. That could be some kind of a caricature of the right Hamiltonian. But it doesn't matter. All the properties will be true in the vicinity of parameter space of this Hamiltonian that I talked about. And it has excitations with restricted mobility. We have particles that are fixed at the points. We have particles that are fixed to move on the line. And we have particles that have funny names, linons, fractons, planons, that are fixed to move on a plane. Let me mention another example. This was an earlier example. It's known as Haas code. So Ha put 2 qubits on every site. So there's a lattice with 2 qubits, 2 spins at every site. And the interactions, again, sigma 1 and sigma 3 at various sites. And it's kind of complicated, but it's not crazy. In the sense, again, finite range interaction, every qubit talks only to a finite number of neighbors. And again, we have an innocent-looking Hamiltonian. Everything looks local and nice. And the behavior is even crazier than in the previous model I mentioned. Again, we have excitations with restricted mobility. By now, we got used to that. But here, the number of ground states is again of the form 2 to a power that depends on the number of sites. But this k is a complicated number theoretic function of the number of sites. It's not even monotonic in the number of sites on the lattice. So think how crazy it is. We have a lattice, and we add one more layer of atoms, one more layer of sites. The Hamiltonian is essentially the same, and the number of ground states drops to be a finite number. You add another layer, and the number of ground states jumps to be a macroscopic number. The behavior as a function of changing these L's is completely erratic. So we're going to be interested in the question, what does it mean to take L to infinity in such a system? And you know we're heading for trouble. The limit doesn't exist. We just look at the answer. The limit doesn't exist. It's not monotonic in L. It's bounded by L. And different sequences of L going to infinity give different answers. So we have to live with that. So is there a continuum model? Is there a continuum limit? The last kind of example I would like to describe in some detail is of totally different nature. And it was motivated originally by attempt by some condensed matter people to write a lattice model that is going to lead to emergent gravity. So the idea was that we'll start with some spin system on the lattice with local interactions, and a graviton will pop out, a graviton with its general covariance. Personally, I think this is completely misguided. So let's get that out of the way. That's not what we are doing, although it motivated this construction. And then Jenker Schuh, motivated by these considerations, considered kind of a variation of what we would call U1 gauge theory or Maxwell theory. So in Maxwell theory, we have A0 and AI, AI being a vector. And here, the spatial components are a symmetric tensor. And we can postulate that this is the gauge symmetry of the model. So there's a U1 gauge symmetry, A0 goes to A0 plus D0 alpha, and Aij transforms gauge transformations with I and J. And at this point, I don't even ask what's the geometrical meaning, what does parallel transport mean, what are the bundles, what fluxes are allowed, etc. Let's postpone this question. So this is the gauge symmetry. And then we can construct gauge invariant field strength, electric and magnetic fields. And you can check that this electric field and this magnetic field are invariant under this gauge transformation. And you can follow our nose and write E square minus B square. And there is kind of a massless photon, a bit of a massless photon with a strange dispersion relation. But so far, everything looks completely standard. And however, things are not so simple. Because when we add matter to the system and we study Gauss' law, we're just doing what Maxwell did. So this is not that original. We're just going through the same steps that Maxwell did when he wrote Maxwell's equations. There's Gauss' law, except that it has two derivatives. And as a result, both electric charge is conserved and dipole charge is conserved. Just if you can just check it with the, because of the two derivatives here, right? You put rho with the two derivatives, and then you integrate by parts, and you realize that both the conserved charge, both the total charge and the dipole charge are conserved. And if both the charge is conserved and the dipole charge is conserved, particles cannot move. Because if you have a particle with charge, and if only charge is conserved, so the particle could be here, and I can also move the particle here. But if the dipole charge is conserved, that's the value of the charge times the position, that's going to be different here and here. And since it's not conserved, the particle is not going to move. This was the understanding of Pretko. So Pretko realized that this model of tensor gauge theory, whatever it means, leads to particles with restricted mobility. This opens many, many questions. Are there more examples, perhaps with more exotic phenomena? What is the underlying reason for the bizarre phenomena? The examples that I gave look completely random and are completely different. What's going on here? One could say, oh, these are esoteric examples. I'm not interested in them. And one can also make an equally valid point that this is just the tip of the iceberg. And there are many other examples that we have not yet seen, and they exhibit these peculiar behaviors and perhaps others. So what are the possible theories of phases? How are we going to organize them or classify them? Is there a continuum quantum field theory description of this bizarre behavior? How should a quantum field theorist in the continuum describe that? And there are many other questions. So we can discuss continuum Lagrangians. We can take these systems and try and take naive continuum limit, write continuum action. So instead of studying the lattice models, let's do quick and dirty, find some continuum Lagrangian. And then we know how to deal with continuum Lagrangian. We just analyze these continuum Lagrangians. In fact, this has been done since the days of Lagrange. Right? It's not anything too creative. So the continuum Lagrangians lead to very interesting systems. First, we have systems with one time derivative and four spatial derivatives, no term with two spatial derivatives. And we can have the sum here over all I and j. This is known in the literature as Lifshitz theory. Or we can have the sum here over I not equal to j. Again, I emphasize that it still looks like it's not too bad. Right? We have a Lagrangian. It's not too bad. It's unlike the Lagrangian that most of us studied, but it does not look that different. Instead of having a Lagrangian with two derivatives, we have a Lagrangian with four derivatives. So the equation of motion, instead of being two derivatives, is going to have four derivatives. But it's a different PDE, so what's the big deal? And for the gauge theories, I've already mentioned that we can have E square minus B square with this funny gauge symmetry. And again, we can sum over all I and J or I not equal to J. And we can also write various Chern-Simons type theories. We have gauge fields, so we can write various Chern-Simons type Lagrangians for these and just follow our nose and see what happens. So there are many approaches. One is to focus on the lattice, the other to write these things and quickly do quick and dirty and see where we land, or trying to think more carefully, what do bundles for these things mean? What do we mean by transition functions and so forth? However, the higher derivative terms lead to important subtleties. The higher derivative terms that I showed in all these continuum Lagrangians are not as innocent as it might appear. And over the last 2.5 years, during the pandemic, I had a fantastic set of collaborators that kept me sane. This is a typical picture of our collaboration as we were trapped in our homes. And that's exactly the kind of questions that we addressed. So I don't have time to summarize what we have been doing, but I'll give you some highlights. Otat is here in the audience, and Shuheng talked here yesterday. I do not know whether he's here online or not, and Pranay, I'm sure, is online. So these are the questions we studied. What do such continuum field theories mean? So I presented some Lagrangian. It looks straightforward. What does it mean? Can we look at the equation of motion? We just do what we normally do. These are quadratic Lagrangians. It should be straightforward. The PDE is a linear PDE. There isn't room for too many subtleties. That's not the case. It's very subtle. One surprising thing is that because of the structure of the derivatives, sometimes the action is not suppressed for discontinuous fields. You could ask, why do we have continuities in field theory? Why are the fields that we study continuous? Normally, in quantum field theory, if we try to consider a configuration in space which is discontinuous, the action for such a configuration is infinite and suppresses it. Here, that's not the case. There is no choice but to study discontinuous field configurations. We should also understand the global structure, fluxes, operators, defects, and so forth. And a very interesting question is, what does all this have to do with the underlying lattice model? Because we just followed our nose and took some kind of limit, and we wrote the continuum model. What does the continuum model have to do with the underlying lattice model? It turns out to be extremely subtle. And we have many results about many models. And I'm going to flash them rapidly here because I'm running out of time. Typically, the continuum model that we write down has more symmetries than the underlying lattice model. That's not new. This is very common that in the continuum, we have more symmetries than on the lattice. For one thing, in the continuum, we have continuous translations, and on the lattice, we have only lattice translation. There are more interesting symmetries that often occur in the continuum, which arise from the fact that field space is we allow only continuous fields, so we have various winding numbers and so forth. So here we could find new lattice models that exhibit more symmetries. And here comes a very surprising result. For me, this is one of the most shocking ones. We take one of these lattice models, and we can study two different limits of it. We are interested in the limit that the number of sites goes to infinity. And I've said that a billion times already in this talk. We're trying to take the number of sites to infinity, and we can do that taking the lattice space and going to zero, holding the total sites fixed. In your first calculus course, that's what you did. When you learned how to do an integral, the integral was defined by doing exactly that. You took the coordinate, you broke it into little rectangles, and then you took a limit that the number of rectangles goes to infinity and the width of each rectangle goes to zero, and in the limit, you find the integral. So this is a very natural limit to take. And if we do that in field theory, for ordinary lattice models, we find a continuum field theory in finite volume. The second limit we can take is what we can call the thermodynamic limit. We take the number of sites to infinity with fixed lattice spacing, and therefore the total size goes to infinity. So these are two separate limits, and normally they commute. We can take one limit or the other. In fact, we do that all the time when we study systems. We start on the lattice with finite lattice. We put it in the computer. There's a finite lattice, and in the computer it's always a finite lattice. And then we take a sequence of lattices with more and more points. You can do it in the computer with a finite number of steps. And we always think that taking the first limit or the second limit, it doesn't matter because the limits commute. They reflect different physics, and therefore it doesn't matter. Here they do not commute. And we can also study other limits, and depending on which limit we take, we find a different continuum theory. By now you're not surprised that I would call it UVIR mixing. So these systems exhibit UVIR mixing, and we can see that both from the lattice and from the continuum. Depending on how we take the continuum limit, depending on how we take the number of sites to infinity, we get different answers. And this is something that for physicists should be very disturbing. Now, the fact that you have functions that depending on how you take the limit, you get different answers, That's not a big deal. We learned that in high school. The function x over y, if you take x to 0 first or y to 0 first, you get different answers. And you can also take both of them to 0 at a particular ratio, and you'll get yet another answer. So that's not a big deal. The fact that we see here something that we try to remove the UV, or we try to remove the IR, we get different answers, this should be shocking. So this brings me to the summary of the talk. I started by talking about quantum field theory. I defined it as the quantum version of a system with an infinite number of degrees of freedom. This has been enormously powerful over the last century or so. It appears to be the language of physics. This is being used in the standard model of particle physics. It's been used in condensed matter physics and so forth. And an interesting principle in quantum field theory is this separation of scales. Going back, it's not just in quantum field theory. This separation of scales is everywhere in human knowledge. Whenever you talk in human knowledge about things at different scales, you don't need to know the details at short distances to know what happens at long distances. This is true in economics. I gave the examples of it in epidemiology. It's true in hydrodynamics. It appears everywhere. And we are very fortunate that this is the case, because this reductionism is what made nature understandable. Otherwise, it would not have been understandable. And most of the details of the short distance theory do not affect the long distance description. However, certain examples in string theory lead, and in lattice model, lead to peculiar systems which are clearly outside this framework. Systems where the short distance and the long distance are mixed together. What happens to the system at long distances is very sensitive to what happens at short distances. And this is surprising. And then we discuss more specifically exotic systems, exhausting systems, including systems of fractals, but not only. And they exhibit interesting properties. And again, the reason I'm interested in them is this UVIR mixing, which manifests itself in several different ways. There is a large ground state degeneracy. Not only is it very large, it diverges, or not even well-defined, as we take the limit. See, it could be diverges, it could diverge, and you say, oh, that's well defined. But what's more bothersome is that depending on how we take the limit, it diverges in a different way. And sometimes it doesn't diverge at all. And we have observables on the lattice that are discontinuous as we move from one lattice site to another. So even in the continuum theory, we need to study discontinuous functions. And we had these excitations with restricted mobility. All these peculiarities seem to be incompatible with the framework of quantum field theory. And therefore, this is an issue that we have to face. So we analyzed a number of non-standard continuum quantum field theories for these systems. The good news is that they capture the universal behavior. So indeed, a lot of the details of the lattice are not important. But other properties of the lattice do still exist in the continuum description. So despite a lot of progress, many puzzles remain. And with this optimistic note, I'll stop and say thank you and stay healthy.
Oh, thanks. All right, well, thank you for a great talk. Can we start with a question from some intrepid student? Anybody? Yeah.
Hi, thanks for the very interesting talk. I was wondering if all of the examples you mentioned have non-standard kinetic terms, or is it just the one example?
So there's a question of what you mean by kinetic term.
Sorry, kinetic, the terms with...
The time derivative is completely standard.
Okay.
The time derivative is completely standard, although you can also mess with that. But the spatial derivatives are not standard, and this is common in these systems. So all these systems have non-standard spatial derivative terms. And all the peculiarities stem from these non-standard spatial derivative terms.
Okay, that answers my question. Thank you.
So one corollary of that is that they are not relativistic invariant. But if I look around, we don't look very relativistic.
Any other questions? Maybe.
Yeah, there was a question.
Yeah.
Does the notion of correlation function, like the, does it still completely make sense in this exotic continuum quantum field theory?
Yeah, make perfect sense. In some of these systems, you can just calculate them. In fact, some of these examples are solvable. So there's a closed form formula for the correlation functions on the lattice. Now, once you have the formula on the lattice, everything is calculable, everything is standard, everything is calculable, and so forth. Very explicit. Once you have the explicit formula, you can start taking limits. And when you start taking limits, all this bizarre behavior hits you in the face. But again, there's no room to hide because the correlation functions are functions. You know, there's nothing funny about them.
Other?
Hello. So can one try to do the usual Wilsonian integrating out the modes and so on that works very well in quantum field theory in these systems? Yes or no? And if yes, does it do something weird? Because I wouldn't expect that.
Yes and yes.
Okay.
And people have actually tried that. And they tried to find kind of a version of the renormalization group when you integrate out some things. And what you find in the system with fewer degrees of freedom tends to something else. You cannot just have gradually reduce and have fewer degrees of freedom. That's not going to work. Something you have to give. But there are some procedures where you integrate out stuff and you have something with fewer degrees of freedom, tensor another sector.
Okay, thanks.
But it's not going to work all the way to the infrared in the sense of getting an long distance.
No, indeed, indeed. Yeah. Okay.
Means you pointed out that there are all these problems, and maybe you are the best person to ask, do you see what direction these problems are leading to? What would be the general framework that would solve things? Some intuition looking at the problems we're facing?
The quick answer is no. One thing is that if you just continue doing it by force, you say, nothing's going to stop me, I'll just do it, then it's unavoidable that you have to consider discontinuous fields. And I talk to some mathematicians, and some of them say, this is crazy. And others said, this is exactly what I've been working on. So I've heard these two ends of the spectrum, and I don't know how to define the space of functions so that if I start multiplying them and adding them, and if I allow some singularities but not others, I should add that the discontinuous fields that need to be considered, these functions, are not as discontinuous as on the lattice. So by going, why do you go to the continuum? We go to the continuum because the functions will be continuous, and then we can use all sorts of things about continuous functions. On the lattice, everything is discontinuous, right? Whatever happens on one side is totally unrelated to what happens in the other side. So these functions and the singularities of them are not as singular as on the lattice, but they are much more singular than in the continuum. For example, we can have a function which is discontinuous in X, but completely continuous in Y. That's an allowed thing. Discontinuous both in X and in Y is not allowed. But discontinuous in X plus discontinuous in Y is allowed. Now, you start multiplying these things, you get out of this set. So there's clearly something to be understood here. I don't know what the rules are, but the systems exist. So it's not a question of, let's invent rules that make sense. We would like to do that. And if you fail, you could say, well, maybe the rules don't make sense and we shouldn't continue. Here, there's something we can always go back to. These systems exist theoretically, not in the lab, but they do exist. So there is a mathematical structure here that exists and makes sense. What we don't have is the proper description of it. And it is, I should really emphasize this point, which is so important for me. People have been saying that about quantum field theory all the time. There is a mathematical structure. It clearly exists. We don't fully understand it. And it has to be understood, and it will be fantastic once we understand that. And personally, I thought, yeah, it's not rigorous, but it doesn't matter. We know what we are doing. Here, we don't know what we are doing. And this is an example that I think vindicates all the mathematicians who were skeptical about maybe these limits don't exist and so forth. Yes, the limits don't exist here. And it's not because maybe they don't exist, but here they actually don't exist. So I think it's actually ask for a mathematician to step in and to tell us what's going on here.
Thank you.
So there's a question from Zoom. Adrian asks, is the restricted mobility of excitations related to the UVIR mixing, or is it another separate sign that something exotic is happening?
Okay, this is a fantastic question. And a priori, it's totally unrelated. A priori, it's totally unrelated. And indeed, there are systems that have particles with restricted mobility, but without the funny ground state degeneracy, and without the UVIR mixing, and the other way around. We have examples where there is funny UVIR mixing, funny ground state degeneracy, but no particles of restricted mobility. We have examples of both. Having said that, we managed to, with these fantastic collaborators of mine, we managed to formulate all these properties following from the symmetries of the problem, both the restricted mobility and the ground state degeneracy. And they both follow from funny symmetries of the model, and different symmetries control these different things. So they are uncorrelated in the sense that these are different symmetries. They are correlated in the sense that both of them follow from the symmetries of the problem. But that would be a lot more technical to explain.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask, in what dimensions do these theories occur?
Okay, so depending on the rule of how much you would like to have, the answer is different. The simplest examples we studied are in one spatial dimensions. These are the simplest example in the lowest number of dimensions. You need to have space. If you have just quantum mechanics, you have none of that. So we have examples with one spatial dimension, so it's 1+1 dimensions. And this is this Lipschitz theory where the Lagrangian is d by dx phi quantity square plus phi dot square.
And this is a free theory, yes?
This is a free theory, yeah, it's free. So there's really, I can't overstate, there's really no room to hide. These are free solvable models, and they are already subtle. Free solvable models. So the simplest example is in 1+1 dimensions, but since it is in 1+1 dimensions, it does not have the full richness of the higher dimensional counterparts. So there's a trade-off, which is always true in mathematics. In 1+1 dimensions, you can study a lot of geometry and topology, but you don't get the full richness as you get higher up in dimensions. The richness that I talked about here, the more interesting ones, like Haskell, the X cube, and other examples, you need at least three spatial dimensions in order to get the full richness. I do not know whether, I heard actually there were some papers doing it above about three dimensions. And I think there's less of a motivation to study that. I do not know whether it leads to genuinely new phenomena or not. So if you want to have a baby version where you can see some of these peculiarity occurring, not all of them, 1+1 dimensions is good enough. If you want more interesting systems, 3+1 dimensions has already all the complications you want.
And also, so you very down to earth question. So you had this function x over y, which had different limits. And this happens because actually you should consider blow up of the plane. So the moduli space, so things live not on the plane, but at the plane blown up at the origin. And you add the projective line, which is all the directions from which you can approach. So this means that when limits don't commute, this means that your moduli space is a blow up. Do you see this in these examples that you have
more in a way, yes, because on the lattice, everything is finite. So if I formulate this problem on the lattice, everything is finite. There's a Hamiltonian on the lattice. I can diagonalize it. I can exhibit the spectrum. And the spectrum is an answer.
The question is, do you get a particular moduli space of limits, limits?
Well, yes, there is a moduli space of limits, but the moduli space of limits, what happens is that I take different limits, various states are pushed either to infinite energy or to zero energy. Now, this is common in physics, depending on how you take the limits. And the general rule in physics is you have to take the limit not too fast and not too slow, kind of just right, so that you don't throw away too much, but you keep enough. The point is that here you can't do that. If you want to keep this part, this state, you must keep this infinite number of states. You know, so you can't get rid of the problem. Now, there might be a much better mathematical way of phrasing all that. I hope there is a much better mathematical way to phrase it. But it's very explicit. It's kind of a, just like when you say x over y, you can explain the limits of x over y to somebody in high school without mentioning the word blow up. And you don't need all the fancier things. And you won't miss much. And you won't miss much. The same thing is true here. This is really down to earth. You can, you know. But I think having a deeper mathematical understanding will really help.
OK, maybe in view of time, just one last question.
Yeah, sorry, about this discontinuous field configuration. I'm a bit confused because also in standard examples of quantum field theory, typically people say that most of the field configuration that you put in the path integral are actually discontinuous configuration, even if the dominating one are continuous. So when you speak about the discontinuous configuration, are you talking about a different kind of discontinuity, and in which sense?
Yes, the answer is yes. So in standard quantum mechanics, you don't even need field theory for that. When you study the path integral in quantum mechanics, you'll go to the textbooks, and the textbook will tell you that the typical configuration in the path integral is not a continuous function of time. Because the continuous functions of time are measure zero, and they're not even the most important ones. This is true, but for most applications, it's totally irrelevant. And you can study the functional integral without ever even knowing this fact. When you're doing small fluctuations around classical solutions, you don't need to know this fact. This fact is needed only in order to avoid some paradoxes. But other than that, you don't. And the reason is that these discontinuous configurations in quantum mechanics have infinite action. But on the other hand, there are many of them. So the reason they are the typical ones is that there are many of them. So there are many configurations with discontinuous action. The discontinuous action makes the contribution of every one of them to the path integral zero, but there are lots of them, so altogether they make a finite contribution. That's more or less the picture. What happens here is that the discontinuous configurations have zero action or finite action. In that sense, they are much, much more important than the other discontinuous functions that you mentioned.
Okay, thank you.
All right, let's call it quits there. Let's thank Nathan one more time for a great talk.